This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How and why did the universe begin, and what is our place in it? Those are some pretty big questions. Answering them is what George Smoot's work is all about. Smoot is a cosmologist. He studies the science of the universe. And in 1992, a team of scientists he led made a discovery so important it's been called the Holy Grail of cosmology. Smoot's team found evidence of the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory says that the universe was created when a particle smaller than an atom exploded and kept expanding and expanding. If the Big Bang theory is true, there would have to be cosmic radiation patterns left over from the explosion. No one could find those patterns until Smoot measured them in 1992. Along the way, Smoot had many adventures, sending his telescopes and spy planes and giant helium balloons and taking them to the South Pole. Smoot has written a new book about his work called Wrinkles in Time. Let's start with an explanation of the Big Bang theory.
It's the idea that the universe isn't always been the same as it is now, but in fact it's been expanding and evolving, that as you go backwards in time, the universe was smaller, things were closer together, it was more dense, it was hotter, and it's more energetic, and that the universe started from an incredibly hot and sort of dense state, and it's been expanding and cooling ever since. As it expands and cools, it is able to build up complicated structures like stars and galaxies and life as we know it. And so in a very simple viewpoint, the Big Bang is just the fact that we live in an expanding and evolving universe.
The Big Bang, if I understand it correctly, says basically that the whole universe came out of a little subatomic particle that exploded and expanded. I find that just impossible to fathom.
Right. When we go and look more carefully and think about what it means for the universe, if we extrapolate back to the very beginning, we can say everything that we can see, and we think we can see out 15 billion light years in any direction, those are tremendously huge distances, everything we can see was once in a place that's such smaller than any particle we know of, smaller than a proton, very subatomic size. And the universe expanded. And what happened is something that's hard to conceive and hard to think of. But what actually happened is not only did the universe, was it hotter and denser then, but there was less space and less material. And as the universe sort of exploded, what it exploded was it made more space, it made more time, and it made more material. And but from a tiny fraction after the beginning, everything that we can see was actually in a region that was extremely small. But a tiny fraction of a second is less than the time it takes light to go across the room.
What kind of evidence do we have that the world started from a subatomic particle which exploded and then expanded to create what is now known as the universe?
All right, well, one of the biggest things that we know is we know the universe is expanding. And this is something that we've known since the late 1920s when the American astronomer Edwin Hubble went out and first showed that these things that were called nebula, that would just look like groups of stars, that a big fraction of them were from outside of our own galaxy. And one of the things that he determined, particularly with the help of his assistant Humason, was that the galaxies seem to be moving apart, that if we look at them, the further away they are, the faster they seem to be moving away from us. And this is what you'd expect in the giant explosion, the giant expansion of the universe. The further away things are, the faster they're moving. And so that's sort of how we came into the name of the Big Bang, the idea that the galaxies were all moving apart. And it's a little bit of misconceptions because a lot of people thought, well, there was this giant explosion and the things that were going fastest went furthest. If you give everybody the same time, you have a big explosion and you go for an hour, the people that are moving 30 miles an hour get 30 miles, and the people that are going 60 miles an hour get 60 miles. And so you make a snapshot, the people are going twice as fast or twice as far away. And so that immediately implanted in people's mind the idea of a giant explosion. But the idea we have now is that it's the space itself that's expanding. And so the analogy that people usually give is a balloon, and you put dots on a balloon, and as the balloon expands, the dots move further apart. And the ones that are farthest apart are moving apart fastest just because of the overall expansion. Now, the idea that the universe is expanding is naturally starts to tell you that the universe is changing with time, and if you extrapolate backwards, it should get more dense.
You found what's considered to be a relic of the Big Bang explosion. It's something from the afterglow of the Big Bang. Where does your discovery fit in?
Well, what we discovered was the equivalent to making a picture of the universe when it's very young. We, using the light that came from the hot early phase of the universe, we've looked at that light. It's traveled to us sort of unchanged since the very early times. And we've gone out and used our instruments and made a map. And this map is what I call a baby photo of the universe. It's a picture of what the universe looks like when it's 300,000 years old. Now, 300,000 years seems like a long time, but if you take the present universe and think of it as a middle-aged person, that's equivalent to a picture of the of a human being when it's 5 hours after conception.
So you have this equivalent of like a baby photo of the universe. What did you find looking at that information that revealed something new?
Once we got this baby photo of the universe, the first thing that impressed us was how uniform it was, that when you look at this picture, the first thing you notice is it's all the same. No matter where you look in the universe, it looked the same. And you have to go down in excruciating detail in order to see any variations. And that's why it took years of observations and analysis in order to get here. And what we found was that there are tiny variations at a parts in a million to a parts in 100,000, variations that show that the universe wasn't exactly a uniform suit to begin with, but there were these tiny variations where there was slightly more matter and energy over here and slightly less there. And those are the variations that are going to turn into the things that we think are interested in the universe. A place where there was slightly more material, by its gravitational attraction, pulled in the material around it. That pulled in even more material until you get this huge aggregation. Sometimes it will turn out to be a galaxy, sometimes clusters of galaxies, sometimes clusters of galaxies, sometimes even larger scale structure. And our evidence is there will be even larger things that are forming that haven't had time to form now. Bigger things take longer time to form. And so this is an exciting thing because it tells us how we got from a very nearly uniform early universe to the present day structures where we see the galaxies, the clusters of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and the larger scale structure.
So let me see if I understand this. You've taken, by measuring light generated zillions of years ago, you've taken a baby photograph of the universe back when the universe was really dense, before it had expanded like it has now. And you found that even though the universe was really dense, there were variations, and you've interpreted that as being a sign that at the very, very start of the universe, there were variations that eventually grew into the great variations that we have now.
So we have a picture of the universe when it was very young, 1,000 times smaller than it is now. And what we see there are what we call the primordial seeds, the seeds that are going to grow into the interesting structure we see today, mm-hmm. all the things that make life possible and make the beautiful pictures of the night sky. But we also can tell, because of some of the things we see are so large, that they had to be present right from the very beginning. They had to be what I would call the birthmarks of the universe. They are the very process of creating space and time and all the matter in it created these small variations. The process that created it was nearly perfect process. I mean, to a part in 100,000, it made the same universe everywhere we look almost perfectly. But the very small machining marks, or whatever you want to call them, the process of making time and space, makes these small fluctuations and makes the universe interesting and exciting.
Your discovery has been called the Holy Grail of cosmology. What are the implications of what you found?
Well, this gets a little more subtle. I mean, one of the problems that the Big Bang was facing was that all the previous measurements before our COBE satellite measurement, we had seen only upper limits. We had seen the universe was smoother and smoother. And so we were wondering, how can the very early smooth universe evolve into the complicated universe we see today? And so for a lot of cosmologists, that was the big thing that we saw, finally a way to explain how structure formed the universe. But for the people who were worried about how the universe actually began, how was space and time formed, how was all the matter generated inside of it, this also provides an interesting clue. So we link the beginning of the universe to the very early stages of the universe until the present day universe. And the fact that we see structure on all scales, just exactly the kind of structure we see today, in fact, structure that hasn't even formed yet, the fact that we see them so early tells us that structure was imprinted right in the time of creation, the creation of time and space and all the matter in it. That was imprinted right at that time. And that tells you something about how the creation occurred, how everything was made. And so that's why it's so exciting for a lot of people, particularly people worried about explaining the grand sweep of how do we come into being and how do we get to where we are today. This is a sort of a keystone that puts everything together and gives us an idea that we're not only on the right track, but that we have hope of learning what happened the first tiny fraction of a second in the creation of the universe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is cosmologist George Smoot, and he was the principal investigator of the team that discovered evidence of the primeval explosion that started the universe known as the Big Bang. That was back in 1992. His book about the discovery and about the Big Bang theory is called Wrinkles in Time. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cosmologist George Smoot. When you and your team made your discovery, you were afraid that the calculations weren't accurate. So you made an offer to the people working with you. What was your offer?
What happened is, as we were making the discovery, what I was afraid was people would get out of the habit of checking to see that we're doing things right and making sure the data were coming in correctly and we're processing correctly and we'd done everything right, and get excited about the results. And so I made an offer. Anyone who could find a mistake that would explain what our results were in terms of us having done something wrong or something funny with the instrument, that they would get a free trip anywhere in the world that they wanted to go. And that was to show everybody we were serious, because what's really important, we're looking for extremely small variations here, this part in a million, parts in 100,000. It's very easy to make a mistake and see something like that, because everything that we're seeing is what happened at the very beginning of the universe. That means anything that happened since then could interfere with our measurements, including our own mistakes. And so it's very important for the group to work together as a team and to be really careful checking over what they did before we ran off and said, we've discovered something exciting, and then, whoops, it's a mistake. We put a 5 instead of a 4 in the computer, and then we got the wrong answer.
So you wanted to make the person who found a mistake into a hero, as opposed to them being a spoil sport who everybody would hate for ruining this great theory?
Absolutely. You have to give people encouragement to come and do the right thing, because everybody gets excited with the result. Nobody wants to be the one that say, oh, everybody made a mistake, we go back, everybody become depressed. No, you want them to be a hero, that they really did their job properly.
Mm-hmm. But of course, nobody found a mistake. There didn't seem to be any mistakes.
Right. Well, no one found a mistake at a large area. There's plenty of small things. We know all kinds of corrections at the 5 and 10% level, but no one found a mistake that could explain everything we saw.
Let's talk about what you had to do in order to make your discovery. First of all, you put microwave telescopes onto U-2 planes. Now, the U-2s were spy planes. Were they still spy planes when you had access to them?
The ones we had access to were at NASA Ames, which is in the South Bay of San Francisco, which made them convenient for us. And before that time, I had been flying things on balloons. And balloons have this unfortunate quality that when they come down, they're not very controlled, and often your equipment is ruined. And then we found out about the U-2 and thought, this is a great thing. We want to do this experiment over and over and calibrate it. And here's a way to have controlled situation where we can get the equipment back and check it each time and then fly it again in a new environment. And so the U-2 was actually still being used as a spy plane in certain parts of the world at that time, but it was no longer making flights over what's now the former Soviet Union. But there was still a lot of, pride and secrecy involved in the U-2. And it was sort of a thrill for us to get to fly on it, because it's such a beautiful plane and because there was this mystique about it.
So before you used the U-2, you sent up helium balloons with your telescope. Describe what a helium balloon is like for something complicated like this. It's not just a regular old helium balloon. It's not like in The Wizard of Oz.
Well, it somehow looks like it looks a little bit like the hot air balloons, only it's much, much larger. We're talking about balloons that hold millions of cubic feet of helium when they're fully inflated. And when they get up to full altitude, they make this sort of spherical shape, and you can see the sun glinting off them. They look like a planet. But if they were on the ground, they would fill up a football stadium. We're talking about really huge things. But they're actually made very flimsily. They're made out of things that are like dry cleaner bag plastic. It's very thin plastic, and so you have to be very careful with them on the ground and have low winds and make sure there's no stresses on them. And so it's sort of this romantic thing like hot air ballooning, only it's bigger and you have to be more careful. And as you let it go up, you think it's going to be this quiet, eerie thing, but it's all this rustling and shaking around of the plastic as it's expanding and shifting and carrying under the weight. And then it sort of lofts off into the evening and the setting sun, and you take data all through the night. And then you have to worry that you keep track of where the balloon is, so that when the daylight comes and you want to send it to the ground and recover it, you can actually see it and find it and hope that it doesn't fall on something that's pretty terrible. And often it does fall onto a mountainside or a tree or someplace that damaged the equipment. You have to start all over again.
Now, you went to Antarctica with your observation equipment. Why is Antarctica a particularly good place to observe what you were looking for?
One of the problems you have when you're observing on the Earth is the Earth itself is very warm. We're used to living in a nice environment. The Earth's temperature is about 300 degrees above absolute zero, whereas the radiation we're looking at is only 3 degrees. But we also have this warm blanket of atmosphere, which today you might not feel that way because of the snow, but it's really warm compared to the coldness of space. And we have to look away from the Earth and look through this atmosphere, and they present big signals compared to the universe as a whole. And so you want to go to high altitude so you can get above the atmosphere and as far from the Earth as you can and shield yourself from the Earth. Well, it turns out Antarctica has a tremendous amount of ice on it. And when we went to the South Pole, we found out that the South Pole has almost 2 miles of ice on it. So you're 2 miles up. So it's like being on top of a mountain. But the nice thing about it is it's extremely flat because it's ice and it's water and the wind is blowing. The South Pole is, in some sense, extremely boring because you get out and look away from the station. All you see is this flat ground stretching as far as you can see it going over the horizon. And the only features of interest are these little things called sastrugi, which are about an inch high, little ripples in the ice where the wind has caught a little bit of ice and made a little bit of a snowdrift. So it's very flat. It's very high. And the atmosphere is very cold. And that freezes out all the water. That's where the ice comes from. And the water is the main variable part of the atmosphere. You know, when you look at the sky, you sometimes see clouds, and the clouds vary around. The oxygen and the other things are pretty much stable. So if you want to make a map of what the sky looks like, clouds get in your way. So if you can find a place where the water is all frozen out, like the South Pole, then it's a good place. And the other thing that happened is, man, it's becoming more and more technological, like the radio and television. There's a lot more broadcasting, and we try to look at sometimes the long wavelengths or the low frequencies. Almost everywhere in the world now, man is broadcasting. But if you go to the South Pole, if you go a couple kilometers away from the South Pole, there's very little man-made interference there. You only have to worry about satellites. Mm-hmm. So we could do good observations there.
Are you absolutely convinced that the universe was started by the Big Bang now?
The Big Bang theory is extremely well explained by all the facts that we see. And we see the universe is expanding. We see the relic kinds of atoms and nuclei that are left over from the Big Bang. We see that there were more, that was more dense in the past. We see the relic radiation left over from the hot phase of the Big Bang. We see the structures, the seeds are going to cause everything we see today and give us an indication of how things started. All those things line up and tell us that the Big Bang is really the right theory. The fact that the radiation has so perfect a spectrum, a thermal spectrum, that we went through this hot phase, all those things tell us the Big Bang is really the right theory. And now we're really in the business of trying to determine what caused the Big Bang to start. Where did the universe come from? You know, how did everything work out so beautifully?
Now, how important is your discovery in making the Big Bang theory more conclusive?
Well, it really tells us we're on the right track, and it tells us that we can really learn things about what happened in the first tiny fraction of a second, the very actual beginning of space and time. And let's put it the other way. Suppose we hadn't seen these variations. Mm-hmm. Then we wouldn't think that gravity is what caused things in the universe. And cosmologists believe that gravity not only tells us the shape of space and time, but it holds together all the structures we see in it. And in fact, it was the source of how these structures came into being. If we don't have these variations, if the early universe is perfectly uniform, we need some new mechanism to make the structures we see. That means gravity isn't the dominant force, and therefore we don't know where we're starting from. Without these seeds, then we need to invoke something new, and we have no idea what that would be. And with these seeds and with what they're telling us about the early universe, we're quite confident that the Big Bang is the right way to go and that we can learn more about it and fit the whole picture together very cleanly.
Do you see any parallels between the Big Bang theory of creation and the story of creation as told in the Bible?
I certainly think that there are a lot of different societies have stories of creation that are very similar. Certainly, the Big Bang and the way we see it now, where it's almost creation from nothing, it's creation by letting it be so, is very parallel to the story of Genesis and the Bible. There are other societies that also have stories like that, some that are very different.
Are you a religious person yourself, and I'm asking that like in the sense of if your religion and your scientific discoveries are ever in conflict.
I usually don't come across and tell people what they should believe in terms of religion. I have my own beliefs, I don't find the conflict between science and religion, and I also happen to be fairly interpretive in my views in terms of how I think religion is, that it tells you about what you should do in terms of morality and ethics. And as Galileo said, you know, religion tells you how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And so I have no problem with religion, you know, dealing with that part of people's lives, and science dealing with the physical world. Each one has its own environment, and I think they can coexist quite well.
George Smoot's new book about the Big Bang Theory and his recent discovery is called Wrinkles in Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.